listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we are willing to give him a run for his money. I'm Sarah Kolb.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, we're delving into all things gothic and bizarre with a story of family curses, spectral hounds, and Sherlock Holmes' skull. It's The Hound of the Baskervilles, the third of four novellas Doyle wrote about Holmes and Watson, and the last one we have to cover on this podcast. You can listen to our narration of the story in four parts by going back a few episodes. We'll be here.
So, The Hound of the Baskervilles was serialized in The Strand from August 1901 to April 1902. It was the first Holmes story Doyle published after, spoiler alert, that thing that's gonna happen in The Final Problem, and its success led to the great detective's eventual revival. Doyle wrote the story after serving in the Second Boer War. It was the first Holmes story he'd published in 8 years, and readers were beyond excited to return to the world of the great detective. He was assisted with the legend and the local color by a Daily Express journalist named Bertram Fletcher Robinson, who took him on a tour of Dartmoor and got paid about £500 for his research assistance.
Wow. Arguably one of the most famous stories ever written, it's generally considered the best of the four Holmes novels. It's safe to say it's certainly our favorite. So, plot. The story begins with Dr. James Mortimer, who brings a story of the Baskerville family to Baker Street. His friend Sir Charles Baskerville was recently found dead of a heart attack on the grounds of his massive family estate, and near his body were the footprints of a gigantic hound.
Ba, ba, ba.
A huge spectral dog, legend has it, killed one of Sir Charles's ancestors. Mortimer is worried that the new Baskerville heir, Sir Henry, from America, will go the same way.
Holmes dismisses the curse as nonsense, but after meeting Sir Henry and realizing he's being followed, with a bit of detective work about following his cab and a boot, he asks Watson to go to Dartmoor to check things out. Holmes apparently stays in London, and Watson gets to go on his own adventure, which quickly gets complicated. There are sinister housekeepers, an escaped convict, mysterious wailing in the night, and an eccentric entomologist named Jack Stapleton with a worried sister named Beryl. Watson takes it all in and writes Holmes some letters, some reports, without getting any replies. It really makes him sad.
Things come to a head when Watson finds Holmes, not in London, but actually camped out on the moor himself. He reveals that Stapleton is the villain and a lost Baskerville relation. The hound is just a dog covered in phosphorus, designed to scare Sir Henry to death. And Beryl isn't his sister, but his abused wife. Holmes sets a trap for Stapleton and is able to slay the hound before it can kill Sir Henry. They rescue the much-abused Beryl, and Stapleton flees across the moor and sinks into it to his death.
And I think the story ends with them going to dinner together at Marcini's, right? I think it's one
of
those
classic a show and dinner coming soon. Yes, it's always the best way to end a Sherlock Holmes story.
Before we get into our thoughts about this iconic story, here's what our narrator Jenna had to say about reading it for you.
Hi everyone. It's an honor to read The Hound of the Baskervilles for you, and I really hope that you enjoyed it. I grew up with Sherlock Holmes in my life because my mom had a full set of all of the stories, bound in cloth, I think, and they were on top of the piano. And I remember seeing them up there as a kid, and when I could, pulling the piano bench to it, grabbing them off there and starting reading when I was little. And they so inspired me that in fifth grade, I actually wrote my own version of Sherlock Holmes that starred a dog detective. I'm sure I was also inspired by the Great Mouse Detective. But I wrote my story, Sherlock Bones and Squatson, which was a dog-based Sherlock Holmes that included a lot of potty humor. I think I gave it to my fifth grade teacher, and I'm kind of regretting it now because I would love to be able to read it again, but I hope that it got some enjoyment out there in the world. So it was lovely to get to read The Hound of the Baskervilles in particular for y'all, because I remember when I first read it as a kid, I was really disappointed at the end because I really actually wanted it to be an actual ghost. I wanted something supernatural to be happening. And when it all turned out to have a logical explanation, I knew that it would, I guess, but I kind of hoped that it wouldn't this time. And when it did, I was a little disappointed that we weren't dealing with a ghost dog. Not to mention the death of the spaniel. That hit me hard. We had a cocker spaniel growing up, and I was not okay. See, this is why the hound should have been an actual ghost. Then, no dog death. Easy fix.
First off, Sarah, what did you think of the Hound of the Baskervilles?
Where to start? Like, it's the best one. It really is. The Wikipedia page is where I got that bit about it being one of the most famous stories ever written, but I'm gonna come out on a limb and say I think it's the best Sherlock Holmes story. It's certainly the best novella. Every time I read it, it just makes me so happy. It's
I fully agree.
It's gothic. It has some interesting structure. I love Watson's letters and the diary entries. I love Holmes skulking around in a cave for like no reason. And I love the ensemble characters. I think they're a real strength.
I fully agree 100%. It is by far my favorite Sherlock Holmes novella. Definitely top five of the stories broadly, but you are right in saying that it actually may be my favorite, because every time I do read it, I just want to luxuriate in the prose, especially anytime Watson is writing his diary entries or his letters to Holmes, which narratively should not work because Holmes is missing for like a third of the novella, but it works so well. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen so far I have not seen a pastiche of Sherlock Holmes in which Holmes is absent for such an extensive length of the novel work so well as Hound of the Baskervilles does.
Yeah, I would argue that Watson's the main character in the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, 100%. And the writing is just so good. It's like Conan Doyle was away for a while and he just comes back with such full force. It would make me so excited if I were reading this when this came out to be like, yes, we're back in it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't, like, the very first sentence I'm going to find really quickly, because I'm trying to imagine being a reader in this time period, having, it's been 8 years, Doyle, you know, dropped mm-hmm. Holmes off of a waterfall. It was really sad. And the opening sentence of The Hound of the Baskervilles is, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who is usually very late in the mornings, save upon those not infrequent occasions when he was up all night, was seated at the breakfast table. And you're just like, oh, we're back.
Chef's kiss.
We're back.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a Holmes image.
I want to live in this novella.
It's so good.
And Watson's writing is just phenomenal. Every time he takes paragraphs to describe the landscape and his eerie feelings about it, I'm like, yes, I want to be in this forever. It's like the perfect September read.
Mm-hmm. I know, our
you know,
timing,
it's starting to get a little bit cooler really out, and I'm like, yes.
Yeah, it's 95 degrees in Denver.
Oh no,
so we're not quite there yet, but I felt the chill in my bones reading Hound of the Baskervilles, even though it hasn't quite happened where I live yet. Yeah, you're right that his writing of like the landscape and the eeriness is so evocative, and I love reading it.
It's so atmospheric. It's delightful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's got some, like you said, fantastic characters. The panache of a villainous entomologist who is plotting
you
murder.
You love a creepy
and
bug plot.
Also, yeah, catching butterflies in his spare time. I love it.
Oh, he's such a weird, good villain.
Great ensemble. The little bit, like, romance happening in the background is also kind of interesting in the way that fits into the rest of the narrative. And I think that this is a very good example of all of the main like tensions across the Sherlock Holmes stories coming to a head. You know, we really got a lot of them, and maybe this is where we want to start with
totally.
Our discussion of talking about some of the big thematic arches occurring in this novella, and then spending a little bit of time later after that about the more interpersonal relationships and characters.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, as I see it, there's a couple different topics here that I think we want to talk about. Four big themes that I want to tackle in this episode. The first just being the gothic and what that's doing here. Bloodlines. And the return of the foreign, which we've talked about so many times, but I think is doing interesting and different things in this narrative, particularly when it comes to the Americas. And finally, of course, science versus superstition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of the big one.
Yeah. So let's start with the Gothic.
Yeah, this I think is right in your wheelhouse.
Is just like framing, you know, where we're coming from for this whole story, because this is like pure distilled Gothic. It's just the most Gothic that it gets, you know. It's wonderful. I mean, it's coming directly out of the late 19th century Gothic revival, where you get things like Dracula and the Beetle and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, all those things percolating in the 1890s to come out. And in the early 20th century, this is maybe one of the last great Gothic novels of that revival. And it's just pure Gothic. It's wonderful.
Big creepy house, desolate landscape, family curse, distressed, abused wife who gets locked in like this creepy building.
The past returning, the, like, which lost, is a huge thing.
Like ancestor returning for vengeance. I mean, it's all the stuff. And then Watson trapped in the house like a damsel in distress.
Yes, yes. I definitely want to talk about that. I guess we can talk about that now, because I think that one of the really interesting things about this novella is how it frames Watson as the Gothic, as the position in which the Gothic heroine would usually foreground, because he is sort of trapped in this hall and is taking in all of his circumstances. He's like going through the hallways at night trying to figure out what's going on with these like candle lights and the escaped convict. You know, he's doing all the like investigation that, you know, someone in an Anne Radcliffe novel would be doing.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I think it's such an interesting position for him to be in this novel, especially since Holmes is completely absent for so much of it.
Yeah, and you get a lot of, like, there are lots of moments of him sort of gazing out at the landscape, thinking about how terrible it makes him feel, and writing letters to Holmes, which is just so moody and wonderful to me.
I really think, too, that the format of the form of the novella reinforces the thematic content, because so many Gothic novels are about narrative complications, like labyrinthine, like twisting and turning, things being sort of difficult to follow. So having letters and newspaper articles is all sort of part of that, you know, where it's not just sort of straightforward first-person prose. We're incorporating a lot of different formative elements here. And one of the first things that stood out to me when I was thinking about this novella as a Gothic text is the fact that the legend was documented in the 18th century, and that one of the characters calls it a, quote, curious old world narrative. So you get those, like, delightful old archives, you know, coming back to haunt the present.
Yeah. It really reminds me, its structure reminds me of Dracula. Not quite to that length, but that, because I'm, like, doing the Dracula Daily email, so I've been, you know, reading along with Dracula, which is That's great. Letters and newspaper articles and people writing to each other and people's diary entries. It's really similar.
It's not just the format of that and the structure, but the idea of the oldness of those narratives coming back to the present is so important. I had a professor who taught the Gothic who always would quote Faulkner's "The past is never dead, it's not even past" line about the Gothic, which I think really does sum up the idea of the Gothic, you know, that it's continuously coming back to haunt the present.
I mean, that sums up The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
And I think there are so many different just delicious Gothic elements of this novella. The degeneration of the estate is really important, which I want to talk about a little bit more when we get to the bloodline stuff. And then just, like, some really horrific events happening. Like, I think this time when I was reading it, the pony's death really troubled me.
Yeah.
It really discomfited me. Yeah. Let me read that if you don't mind.
Please do, because it's, yeah,
grotesque. So Watson writes that something brown was rolling and tossing among the green sedges. Then a long, agonized, wreathing neck shot upward, and a dreadful cry echoed over the moor. It turned me cold with horror, but my companion's nerve seemed to be stronger than mine. So this is a pony getting sucked up in the bog.
Poor pony.
Really unsettling.
Yeah. And Watson's like, watch this happen, right? Like, watch Watson and Stapleton are watching this horse.
Yes. Get sucked up. With nothing, like, there's nothing they can do about it.
And also delightful foreshadowing, because this happens to Stapleton at the end of the novel.
And there are so many elements of this throughout the novella, just, like, this, like, very eerie sensibility. Another one that I really liked was when Watson says that it's on the same page, essentially. It's just, like, at the bottom of the page, where Watson says that a long, low moan, indescribably sad, swept over the moor. It filled the whole air, and yet it was impossible to say whence it came. From a dull murmur, it swelled into a deep roar, and then sank back into a melancholy, throbbing murmur once again. Just the thought of being on this desolate moor, you know, and hearing these strange noises, it's so disturbing.
Well, there's one moment later in the novel, when he and Holmes are kind of running around at night, when they hear the same sound, and he says it's like the ocean, which I thought was really descriptive, just this huge, just like, noise that you don't know where it's coming from. I love, he's in fine form in Watson. This episode. Yes. His writing is really just
absolutely
top notch.
Yeah. You also have some notes about Baskerville as a character.
Yeah, I mean, at least for me, this is kind of a hallmark of a certain type of mystery horror story, because I really do think this, and if we're thinking about more modern genre, Watson hops out of a mystery sort of adventure story where he usually is into a horror story for a little while anyway. And the, like, big creepy houses and desolate landscapes being part of the character of what's happening, and almost like the villain of the horror story, is a trope that I always really love. And so one description that I really liked of this was Watson is writing, I think, describing this to Holmes, and he says, "The longer one stays here, the more does the spirit of the moor sink into one's soul, its vastness and also its grim charm."
I like the idea of the estate and the landscape as a character itself having its own consciousness. It's very Shirley Jackson.
Very Shirley Jackson. Yeah, like impacting people's sense of well-being and kind of their sanity.
Right. I would love then to sort of talk about how that leads into the bloodline stuff, because I really think that so much of this novella is about both protecting lineages and the wealth and estates that are, you know, passed down through those, but also warning against what happens when some of the elements of those bloodlines go awry. You know, when you get a few rotten apples, like Hugo or like Stapleton.
Right, yeah.
You know, because so much British literature, broadly speaking, is about bloodlines. I mean, you can look at so much children's literature is about that, but so much Victorian literature is also about that, like contemporary children's literature is still very heavily focused on this idea of bloodlines, but it's about this idea of, you know, the patrilineal handing down of wealth and estate, and the Baskerville Hall is in complete disrepair, so it relies on first Sir Charles, who is bringing his money in to, like, spruce up the place, but then later Sir Henry, whereas Stapleton is just trying to suck dry all of the money from Baskerville Hall, doesn't necessarily care about keeping up and, you know, embellishing the community or whatever, but is more worried about his individual, you know, financial gain. So it's interesting because it's doing these sort of, like, competitive, like, it's pretty conservative, broadly speaking, because it really does protect that lineage by the end of the narrative. And that's really what it's concerned about. But it's also interesting that in Stapleton, you have the almost worst version of that. The way that the Gothic helps set this up is that, you know, you have this long-lost relative. You know, if you transgress, you are punished.
Well, and of course, Stapleton looks exactly like Hugo Baskerville.
Right.
Who is the Baskerville that invited the curse, because he kidnaps this woman and he's clearly going to, like, rape and abuse her. It's this really, like, dark, sinister story in the past of this family. And it's sort of, like, literal, like, oh, they look identical. It's a little on the nose.
It's literally a return of the past.
Right, yeah.
And I think the whole narrative is kind of hinged on this, the result of this, you know, whether or not the estate is going to be handed down to the correct person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And both Sir Charles, who's Henry's uncle, right? He yes. sort of described as yes. being altruistic, and he's like connected to the mm-hmm. townsfolk, and he cares about their well-being. Right. And Henry's also kind of talked about the same way. And he's, mm-hmm. I think, starts making some, or at least talking about updates on the estate when he gets mm-hmm. there.
Because it is in such disrepair, which, again, Gothic, and Henry is coming to spruce the place up. You're right, though. Mortimer says that, "I feel that if Sir Charles had spoken with me before his death, he would have warned me against bringing this, the last of the old race and the heir to the great wealth, to that deadly place. And yet it cannot be denied that the prosperity of the whole poor, bleak countryside depends upon his presence. All the good work that has been done by Sir Charles will crash to the ground if there is no tenant of the hall." So everything is reliant on Henry.
Yeah, because I think part of my question is, like, why Sir Henry wants to live there?
Yeah.
In the first place. But I think that helps explain it, particularly if he's, like, kind of a guy of good character anyway, and mm-hmm. feels some obligation to do the right thing in this case.
Right. Well, I think we can maybe shift into this, like, return of the foreign, because I think that explains it a little bit, talking about, you know, the United States and his being American. I don't know, like, how are you reading what the United States is representing in this narrative, or Henry as a sort of pseudo-American?
Like, at times it describes when he's angry or when he's really passionate, his accent gets more Americanized. Mm-hmm. He lived there for a long time. Often also, interestingly, that will come up at the same time when they're talking about his, like, classic Baskerville temper, mm-hmm. which he seems to have inherited. I don't know. It's interesting because clearly he is off being rugged and who knows mm-hmm. what, somewhere broadly in the West, broadly.
Right.
I don't think it's ever specific. And then comes back to England and to his, like, ancestral homeland, and then is under threat from the family curse. So it's following him, but it can't get him until he's back in England?
To me, like, his being in the United States is sort of a way for Conan Doyle to have his cake and eat it too, and that he is British so that he's able to inherit the hall, but he also represents the sort of, like, renewal and freshness and breathing life into the old crumbling estate. And that
sort of modern versus
ancestral. And there's a one passage that I think is really nice, which is when they are approaching the hall for the first time, and Watson is, like, paying attention to how gloomy the landscape is, but Baskerville is just, like, fixed on the house. Like, he is just, like, staring at the house, and Watson says that, quote, "I read upon his eager face how much it meant to him, this first sight of that strange spot where the men of his blood had held sway for so long and left their mark so deep. There he sat with his tweed suit and his American accent in the corner of a prosaic railway carriage, and yet as I looked at his dark and expressive face, I felt more than ever how true a descendant he was of that long line of high-blooded, fiery, and masterful men. There were pride, valor, and strength in his thick brows, his sensitive nostrils, and his large hazel eyes." Okay, Watson. If on that foreboding moor, a difficult and dangerous quest should lie before us, this was at least a comrade for whom he might venture to take a risk with the certainty that he would bravely share it. So, a lot of things happening here.
Watson, again, is falling in love with someone he has just met.
Right, exactly.
It's he's chronic. He can't help it.
His description of Baskerville as both, like, obviously part of this lineage, but also someone who is, like, American and able to, you know, pull himself up by his bootstraps and tackle adversity and, you know, seems to be, like, the perfect pairing for someone to be able to actually, you know, survive the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah, true. That's a good point. He is sort of I'm trying to think, like, if he was a horror trope, what horror trope character he would be, mm-hmm, Sir Henry, mm-hmm. But I do agree it's the right combination where he never quite buys into the curse.
Mm-hmm.
But he's almost at the edge of doing that a couple of times. Right. But something always kind of pulls him out. And part of it, I think, is his sensibility and his other experiences and his sort of like more modernized, for lack of a better word, way of thinking about science and logic and mm-hmm. the world. And he's also kind of a romantic. Like, he's also trying to yes. have a dalliance with this woman. So,
yeah, which I think we should talk briefly about, because on the other side of this coin, of this American coin, is Central America. Yeah. There is one moment where they say that Roger, who is Mr. Stapleton, made England too hot to hold him and fled to Central America. So that is where he has been living. And that is where he finds Beryl, marries her, brings her back.
Right.
So it's interesting that Central America, just like all the other stories that we've been reading, always returning to the Speckled Band as the, like, prime example of this, but the foreign returning to, you know, create some trouble back in the homeland. And also interesting that I think that Beryl might be the only woman of color significantly featured in the stories. Is that true?
I think you're right. And she's described in such a very Victorian way, mm-hmm. but I do like the sentence where, and granted, for a long time people think they're siblings and it's kind of like they don't look anything yeah. alike. So I don't really know how people buy this, but whatever. But Watson describes it. There's something, and I'm mm-hmm. quoting Watson here, mind you, tropical and exotic about her, which forms a singular contrast to her cool and unemotional brother. So they're interesting, and their like physical depictions of them are very opposite, and he is very blonde and British mm-hmm. and she is not, but then he has this fiery temperament,
right,
that maybe drew him to Central America, probably, in Doyle's eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that him, that line of being like he made England too hot to hold him, sort of speaks to this idea of like sentence, yeah. the tropics and temperament and these ideas that, like, you know, if you were a white person in the 19th century that was born in, like, the West Indies, for example, you weren't considered as fully British, you know, because, like, the tropics and the temperament and the temperature literally would affect you and your bloodlines and stuff. But I think this is also just interesting because it gets back to this idea of bloodlines, in that, like, as you said, like, Henry and Beryl have this sort of romance formulating, and then she is just yeah. completely tossed to the side by the end. And that sort of, like, prevents any, like, foreign, quote-unquote, like, infiltration into the Baskerville bloodline.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah.
Because I always feel like they're going to end up together, and then they just yeah. fully do not.
Yeah. I think that would, maybe if she was a slightly different character, it would have happened mm-hmm. that way. And I think it would have been a nice ending. And I'm like, Sir Henry's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. Come on. But yeah, that's a good observation. She is too Central yes. American.
Well, he finds out that she's married and she's from Central America. So that is a no-go for Henry, I guess. Eh. Rough stuff.
Come on, Henry.
And then
you can figure out those things out. Come mm-hmm. on.
Finally, we got to talk about science and superstition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the big thing. The sort of, like, guiding force.
This is a Sir Henry quote right when they meet him, where he says to Holmes, "You don't seem quite to have made up your mind whether it's a case for a policeman or a clergyman."
That's pretty good.
Which I think nicely summarizes this theme in the story.
Like, very The Exorcist.
Yeah, I know.
So, we all know that Holmes is supposedly the pinnacle representative of rational thought, and that the Conan Doyle stories are the pinnacle of scientific thought and logic and rational deduction, right? And yes. that is sort of what this narrative is doing. It is really presenting superstition versus science and allowing science to win out through the day. And that mm-hmm, is, mm-hmm. you know, quite typical of a certain branch of the Gothic. I mean, Anne Radcliffe, who is really credited with making the Gothic what it is. There's a novel that predates her that's considered the first Gothic novel, called The Castle of Otranto, but Anne Radcliffe's career was so successful and prolific and really just kept like the Gothic going throughout the 19th century. She was like a late 18th century writer. Really just stems, like, so much of what's going on in Hound of the Baskervilles, I think, can go back to Anne Radcliffe, because her most famous novel, The Castle of Otranto, is all about the rational versus superstition. And the main character in that, in a very, like, sort of Watsonian circumstance, is, like, trapped up in this castle, is trying to figure out what's going on, is trying not to let superstition get the better of her, you know, but all these, like, seemingly superstitious things happen, but by the end, they're all explained with rational thought, and yet it is still a Gothic novel. So that is, like, one branch of the Gothic. You also have things like Dracula, in which the supernatural is real. So this is really borrowing from a sort of Radcliffean lineage of the Gothic. However, I found a couple articles that I think were pretty interesting that sort of posit that these aren't as, you know, scientific novels as much as we might think that they are. So the first one is called Degeneration, Fin de Siècle Gothic, and the Science of Detection, Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, and the Emergence of the Modern Detective Story by Nils Clausen. And essentially what this person is saying is that they want to reconsider the Gothic and the context of The Hound of the Baskervilles within that genre at the turn of the century. So what they write is that, quote, viewed as a detective story, The Hound of the Baskervilles appears to dispel magic and mystery, to make everything explicit, accountable, subject to scientific analysis. But as a Gothic tale that relies heavily on the conventions of contemporary Gothic narratives and on the discourses of degeneration, it questions and even subverts the aspirations of criminal science to subject crime and criminality to scientific analysis. By re-examining Conan Doyle's most famous home story as a Gothic tale, the author basically says that they want to show that the modern detective story has its origins not in 19th century scientism, but in fin de siècle, so like 1890s, decadence and degeneration. Mm-hmm. And this is so obviously a Gothic tale, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly his most. But, I mean, like, we always, so often are bringing up The Speckled Band, and I feel like it has a lot of the similar sensibilities and similar themes and imagery, too.
I agree.
So it's certainly not something that Doyle doesn't play with in other stories.
But this is definitely the most supernatural of his stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? The other one that I thought was interesting was called The Savage Subtext of the Hound of the Baskervilles by David Grylls. So this is a chapter from Sherlock Holmes in Context. And this author is contending that the Sherlock Holmes canon's power doesn't come from rational deduction or only from rational deduction, but that there's also this sort of like relationship to the masterpieces of the late 1890s fiction, like this previous article was saying, that is, you know, allowing readers to luxuriate in those sort of like decadent and degenerate themes. This person writes that on the face of it, The Hound of the Baskervilles seems to endorse rationality and materialism at the expense of the supernatural. It seems to set up a conflict between the superstitious past and the scientific present, which is like super Dracula, right? I mean, that's what Dracula is explicitly about. However, this person continues to say that the novel arranges not only for the apparently supernatural effects to be explained and for supernatural to prove suicidal, but also the fact that there are other kinds of descriptions in the story that operate on a quite different level, not offering satisfaction to the rational mind, but provoking primitive fears and horrors. These are the descriptions of the Dartmoor landscape, especially the fearsome Grimpen Mire. As soon as we leave London for Devon, a creeping horror is powerfully emphasized. I really liked this because it's sort of positing that while there isn't necessarily like a literal supernatural force happening with the hound, that the landscape is essentially functioning as the fantastic. And
Fascinating.
The author also points out how many times the word fantastic is used to describe the landscape and, you know, really digging into the descriptions of the landscape and how Watson, you know, writes about it. finally, with this article, the author writes that the novel is built on the contrast between science and superstition, the rational and the pre-rational parts of the mind. An important aspect of this contrast is the treatment of the past, more specifically, the treatment of atavism, the unwelcome return of the past. The moor is not only treacherous and evil, it is also prehistoric. Even though it seems that this all the superstition and the past has been dispelled, it is just, like, embedded within the landscape.
I like that because you get the imagery of our master rationalist Holmes, like, living in one of these prehistoric stone houses. So that's a really interesting contrast. And then I'm also thinking about, like, who's doing the murders and how the murders in the story are being committed. Stapleton is a villain, but he doesn't actually kill anybody. And he is not killed by anybody. The Moor kills him, and then Sir Charles, all of these sirs, my God, has a heart attack because he is an old man and he's running away from this dog. And the dog almost kills Sir Henry, but again, the dog is a dog. It's not a person. It's these, like, acts of nature that are being sort of manipulated, I guess, but...
So I think all these themes are really dependent on each other, really playing off one another to make The Hound of the Baskervilles what it is, which is just... I think a masterpiece of gothic fiction, a masterpiece of gothic detective fiction. It's really all I want out of a Sherlock Holmes story. And it even ends with the most perfect, like, dinner and a show, Watson.
Yeah, I love it so much.
So should we talk about any, like, lingering thoughts we have about characters or any, like, things that don't quite fit into the broad strokes of the themes that we were discussing?
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Watson, as usual, and this idea that Watson is kind of the main character and the driving force in The Hound of the Baskervilles. I think there's just a lot of really lovely language and descriptions of Holmes sort of talking Watson up to people as they're sort of convincing him, and also as Holmes is convincing Watson to go on this journey by himself. And also in the early, they're playing the game where they're looking at Dr. Mortimer's stick, and then Watson is doing his best to figure out what's going on, and he is sort of right, but mostly wrong, which again is sort of the gist of the whole story and his detective activities, which he tries really hard. He puts some things together, but Holmes, you know, is a couple steps ahead of him as usual. But this is this really famous quote about Watson that I just want to read. So Holmes, first couple pages, he says, "I'm bound to say that on all the accounts which you have been so good as to give of my own small achievements, you have habitually underrated your own abilities. It may be that you are not yourself luminous, but you are a conductor of light. Some people without possessing genius have a remarkable power of stimulating it."
Perfect.
Which is such a good line, and also, like, a weird backhanded compliment.
Yes, definitely.
And I think it's really delightful.
It is. It's really sweet. They have a couple of really sweet moments, actually, in the story. I love their reunion on the moor. That's really good. Watson says, "For a moment or two, I sat breathless, hardly able to believe my ears. Then my senses and my voice came back to me, while a crushing weight of responsibility seemed in an instant to be lifted from my soul. That cold, incisive, ironical voice could belong to but one man in all the world." It's so sweet.
Yeah. I love that the contrast of hearing Holmes's, like, very dry, sardonic voice and being like, "It's my best friend."
It's really good. I also really love a line early in the narrative where Watson is like, "Hey, do you want me to, like, go run after Henry while they're still in London?" And Holmes says, "Not for the world, my dear Watson. I am perfectly satisfied with your company if you will tolerate mine."
I love that.
And then they go for a walk, but that's, like, really, you know, some investigation. But I really like that.
A little spying adventure. At one point, Holmes says of Watson, "It is at the hour of action I turn to you for aid," which I really liked. And Watson also talks of his own, like, athletic prowess a couple times in the story, which I think is really funny. Because he does a lot of running around on the moor after a lot of different people. Yeah, in terms of Holmes, it's the little line about a previous case with the strange affair of the Vatican cameo gets mentioned.
Yes, that's funny.
That pops up in Sherlock, and it's not explained at all, but that's something that Holmes was preoccupied with, and he was helping out the Pope.
Yeah, he's got, like, anxiety about helping the Pope, you know.
Yeah. And then there's this really very silly scene where he astral projects.
Yes. Yes. I read that, that part too.
You know what I'm talking about? I love, because Watson... and they seem to still be living together in the story. If we're, like, putting it chronologically, Watson has just gotten engaged.
Yes.
But they seem to be living in Baker Street.
Yes. So together. My sense
Mary is not mentioned
is that Watson and Mary are engaged, but not yet married, and so not yet living together.
But point is, Watson sort of senses Holmes needs to think and gets out of his hair and goes to his club for the day. And then he comes back and he's like, what have you been up to? And Holmes
astral projecting.
My body. Basically, my body has remained in this armchair and has, I regret to observe, consumed in my absence 2 large pots of coffee and an incredible amount of tobacco. I sympathize, Holmes, I get you. After you left, I sent down to Stamford's for the ordnance map of this portion of the moor, and my spirit has hovered over it all day. I flatter myself I could find my way about. So, you know, even our master rationalist gets a little fanciful in this story, too. What are you talking about? No idea. Mm-hmm.
All this to say, I think, is that, like, Holmes and Watson are pretty buddy-buddy. And they're really, like, close. And it'll be interesting to see in the forthcoming stories when we start to see the splinter and when we start to see, you know, Watson moving out, when we think that's going to be.
Yeah.
And when we think, like, Watson's married and how Holmes is taking it. So this is, like, a really good, you know, like, these two are on the same level.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like, in the gist of the story, it's just because of the chronology and when this was written. And Doyle is just presenting them, like, back in their old dynamic without thinking too much about it.
I don't care. So it's our chronology and it works for us, so I do not care.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes it fascinating. Clearly they had some tension and now they're kind of just electing to ignore it. They're like, oh, this is a great mystery.
Yes. Well, and you have some other good lines that you pulled too about the relationship in this story.
Yeah, there is a little bit of tension towards the end, which is a theme we've seen a little bit and we are gonna see it again, and it's really, again, foreshadowing for the final problem. Which is this thing that Holmes outright lies to Watson in this story, because he tells him he is staying in London to investigate some blackmail case to send Holmes to Baskerville Hall, and then does not stay in London and spends a week or so sleeping in a cave and eating bread by himself, doing his own investigation. And this hurts Watson's feelings when he finds this out. He says, "You use me and you do not trust me," he says with some bitterness. "I think I have deserved better at your hands, Holmes."
Yes. And this goes back to this idea, too, that where Watson says that, you know, that Holmes's major defect is that he was exceedingly loved to communicate his full plans. And he says it's partly because, like, you know, his masterful nature, which loved to dominate and surprise those around him, but also professional concern, I guess.
Yeah. And Holmes sort of tries to explain why he didn't let Watson in on his plans. It's like, you're just too good a person and you would have worried about me out here and you would have wanted to, like, bring me cigarettes or something actually to eat and you would have given the game away. Which we've seen this. I mean, it's kind of in The Adventure of the Dying Detective. It's the theme of, like, I can't tell you the truth.
You wear your heart on your sleeve.
You're too compassionate and people will know what's going on. Sorry. So put a pin in that because it's going to come up.
Sure is.
Again, as it has come up before.
I mean, I guess we got to mention the phrenology bit. With the touching of the skull.
We gotta talk about wacky Dr. Mortimer. Yeah.
Which, like, I don't think we need to dwell too much on. It's just a very funny, strange little scene. But the one thing I think about it is that it does harken back to Doyle's critique of, like, contemporary criminology, of saying, like, this stuff is, like, really out of date. It doesn't make any sense. So he's, like, presenting, like, this doctor who is, like, trying to investigate this mystery and is also, like, feeling Holmes's skull, which is just, like,
I covet your skull, is what he says.
Great line. It's just not...
Strange guy.
It just doesn't do anything. And, like, I don't think that phrenology was taken that seriously at this time period, too. So it's an interesting little bit. But it's funny, also.
It is funny. Trying to think of their other little character moments. Sir Henry has one really good line. I don't really have a ton to say about Sir Henry, except I like him.
I think
he's
a good
character. Yeah. He's a good protagonist. Mm-hmm. I think he and Watson have a fun little bromance. The bit where they're, like, staying up all night to try to catch the housekeeper while he's doing the lights, I think is fun. He observes at one point, he says, "I seem to have walked right into the thick of a dime novel."
That's good.
Which I do like a lot. And then there's one other really good line from Lestrade, who makes a very brief appearance in this story. He comes in on the train right at the last chapter, and someone asks him if he's armed, and he goes, "As long as I have my trousers, I have a hip pocket, and as long as I have my hip pocket, I have something in it."
So,
which is a good one-liner.
Yes.
Can we talk adaptations.
Yeah, we should talk adaptations. Because there's a lot.
There are so many. There are so many. And we really cannot ruminate a great length on any of them. But we are going to do a little mini case file about the Hammer horror.
Peter Cushing. Hound
with Peter Cushing. Because I feel that it deserves its moment in the sun. So that'll be coming up next. Something short. An excuse for us to watch the movie and talk about it in a little bit more depth. But Hound is certainly, I mean, it's one of the most famous Holmes stories, so it's one of the most adapted stories ever. But the tone and faithfulness is all over the map. Here are a couple of notable adaptations in a big list. The first ever film adaptation was actually a German film, silent film, in 1914. It was the first foreign language adaptation also. Rathbone and Bruce did it in 1939. The 1959 Hammer horror feature film stars Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee in it, too, right? Yes,
Stapleton villain.
So I'm really looking forward to watching that. Russian Holmes did it in 1981.
Wait, I need to pause at the Russian Holmes one very briefly and just say two things about it. One, Henry is ridiculous in it.
Oh, this is right. I've completely forgot.
He's like a man-child, sort of. Like, he's just like, he's so babied throughout the whole thing. Especially at the end. No. But he's also very fun, and I love him very much. The other part,
I don't think that's not in character, but it's really funny.
Really goofy, right. It's great. He's supposed to be American, and he looks like just like the most Russian man alive. And then I also really like the reunion scene, because you get a nice little hug. It's very sweet between Holmes and Watson.
They are huggers in Sophia Holmes, for sure. Yeah, the Granada version has Jeremy Brett, obviously, and Edward Hardwick. A guy named Raymond Adamson plays Sir Henry. And a funny little bit I really like is that Holmes is trying to do his cooking when he's living in the cave, and he tries to get Watson to eat some of his soup, and it's gross, and it makes me laugh. Other than that, it's a pretty faithful adaptation. I think it's pretty good. It comes up in Sherlock. It's in the second season. Something about dogs that are being experimented on in a lab. I don't really remember that episode in great depth. And then there's an episode in Elementary called Hounded, loosely based on the story. There are lots and lots and lots of stage adaptations and stage spoofs. Notable for theater nerds, Ken Ludwig did an adaptation of Baskerville called Baskerville, a Sherlock Holmes mystery. He's really known for adapting a lot of Agatha Christie novels for the stage in really successful ways. The frontman from Yes, the band, wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles as a prog rock album in 2002.
I have to listen to this.
I don't know anything about it, but someone's right gonna now. Check it out. And then fairly recently, in 2021, Audible released an adaptation of the story with Colin Salmon as Holmes and Stephen Fry as Watson. I also wanted to talk very briefly about a couple of notable pastiches and essays and things dealing with Hound. It's one that gets pastiched. I mean, Laurie R. King, who has a lot, many Holmes novels, has one called The Moor from 1998, where her character, Mary Russell, and Holmes return to Dartmoor on a later case. And there's the very famous sort of like essay thing called Sherlock Holmes Was Wrong, which is by this French writer named Pierre Bayard, who basically argues that everybody, including Holmes and Doyle himself, was wrong about who the killer was, and the killer is actually Beryl Stapleton, not Stapleton himself.
I mean, that would be cool. I would watch an adaptation of that.
Yeah. I haven't read this. I've read other people's critiques of this, and people generally agree it's kind of obnoxious and annoying.
Too bad.
And then I don't want to talk about at great length because we have both read this novel and neither of us enjoyed it, but I think we need to point out there was sort of like a pastiche sequel to Hound written in 2020 by this guy named James Lovegrove called Sherlock Holmes and the Beast of the Stapletons.
Mm-hmm. And he's done quite a few Holmes pastiches as well.
Kind of along that same lines of like they didn't catch the right killer and they have to go back to help Sir Henry with more mysterious happenings and Beryl is a more major character, but I thought it was not a very good book, so I don't have anything positive to say about it, unfortunately. I think there's a lot of space for pastiche that deals with these characters because they're good, but this one was not it.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of real likes, off the top of my head, I would definitely say we mentioned Shirley Jackson, so So The Haunting of Hill House, the house being alive, the landscape, I think that's pretty intriguing comparison with this.
Yeah, I agree.
We mentioned The Exorcist, which might be interesting in terms of like a science versus superstition theme. And we did not mention this, but while we were reading some of the descriptions of the low moaning on the moors, I was thinking about Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting.
Just like the unsettling landscape and...
Yeah, I mean, that's very much like landscape as character, as setting, as the thing that's killing you, I think plays with a lot of the themes that grow out of this genre for sure. And it's so good. Right. That's Jeff Vandermeer.
Yes. So I don't want to go too deep into it because there are so many pastiches and there are so many adaptations. And I'm excited to talk about the Peter Cushing adaptation a lot. Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, it never gets old. So that'll be fun. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for the short story, The Adventure of the Copper Beeches. Ooh, a really creepy one. The creepiest of them all, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, I would agree.
And a special thanks to the narrator of this story.
You can send your thoughts to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website is howeverimprobablepodcast.com. We'll put the research behind the episodes, some of the things we've been recommending, this list of adaptations. If you want to listen to the Yes Prog Rock album about Hound.
Yes.
We'll put that info up there. So you can tell us what you think about that.
Yes to yes.
Yes to yes. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.